Hi, this is Bobby Unser. It's always better to have more front wings.
Hello and welcome to another More Front Wing podcast. I'm Steph Wolcraft, joined by my co-editor Paul Dalby, and we're also joined again this week by More Front Wing site contributor John Lingle. John, it's great to have you back.
Good to be back.
Very excited to talk about the month of May, no doubt, what everybody is all that anybody is interested in talking about right now. But before we get into that, we feel somewhat obligated to take a look back at Brazil because we haven't had a chance to talk about it since it happened. And my goodness, what a race. You just can't let that one go by without at least a mention of how it was really one for the ages with the end of race dicing Sato holding or trying to hold everyone off and then having to give it up to James Hinchcliffe right in the last lap, last corner. That's just the kind of racing that everybody likes to see. What were your impressions of it, Paul?
I thought it was one of the greatest street races I've ever seen, street or road course races. It was just great from beginning to end. The last, 10 or 15 laps were, seriously, just on the edge of your seat sort of excitement with, it looked like Hinch was out of it for a while. Then all of a sudden he just comes storming back. You thought Newgarden maybe has a chance to win this for Sarah Fisher. Taku throws the, widened car maneuver, maybe?
Widened car.
On Newgarden. Throws another widened car maneuver.
Move?
What's that?
Is that a Pokemon move?
It might be. So he throws the questionable move on Hinch on the last lap, and then Hinch ends up with this great over-under move to beat him on a drag race to the checkers. It was just an absolutely fantastic race from beginning to end. One of the best I've ever seen on a road or street course.
Despite all of the carnage? Because there was an awful lot of carnage, and there were an awful lot of yellow flag laps. And up until that last 15-lap stint, I think I was thinking to myself, oh, geez, this one's just really going to be remembered for the times we were going slow.
I never really felt like it was so bad that it broke up the rhythm of the race. I don't know. Maybe it's just because the last 10 laps were so good that I have this revisionist history of it, and I kind of forgot about all the first, 75 laps or whatever it was.
I never felt that
bugged by the yellows this time, really. There was one in there that I thought was pretty excessively long. I forget which one it was or why it was even out, but it seemed like it kind of went on forever and ever and ever. But the slight modifications, I thought, to turn one really cleaned up a lot of the carnage that we had seen in previous years and helped the race kind of get going a little better than it had previously.
It did seem to. John?
I was going to say that it kind of had that almost like a NASCAR race quality to it, where the first three quarters of the race were somewhat forgettable, but the finish was so good there at the end that you remember it and say, man, what a race. You kind of tend to gloss over the first 75% because the last 25% was so good. But I agree that the widening turn one seemed to help. And I was sitting there thinking about this race the other day, and I'd be interested to know what other people think, what their suggestions on it might be. But I can't think of a better finish that we've had on a road and street course.
It's just such a shame that the timing of it being right before Indy and it being on NBC Sports Network and it being in Brazil, the likelihood is that not as many people saw this one as would typically see even an IndyCar race, let alone any other sort of high-level motorsport event. So I really hope that I know that there's been some publicity, especially in Toronto, because, Hinchcliffe having come away with the win, there's been some chatter here in town. Some of the big sports TV and radio show hosts have given it a little bit more attention than they usually do and said, hey, you know what, there's actually some pretty good racing going on in IndyCar right now. So I hope that incites some people to if not go back and check out the Brazil race, then at least give a look to IndyCar as something to look at going forward. And there's enough going on later on this year that maybe we'll get those little pushes in the right direction. But when we're talking about the end of this race, there is one topic that we need to address before we can put it in the books, and that's the discussion of A, whether Sato was in fact blocking, and B, whether Bo Barfield did the right thing by leaving him out there. John, you want to take this one first?
Yeah, you know, and even Sato, whenever they asked him about it, he kind of had that coy smile and said possibly, mm-hmm. which if a driver says that they possibly blocked, that means they were blocking their tail end off. And, you know, there were some pretty blatant moves there. And I think it ended up well because the faster guy got through. I mean, it made for a great finish, the move Hinch made there on the last corner. That's a classic maneuver and just made for a great ending. But I think this really could have ended up being a big can of worms for Bo Barfield if he hadn't made that call or hadn't made any calls and Hinch hadn't got by. Because, you know, Newgarden was mad after the race. He pulled up beside Takuma on the cool-down lap, and Hinch would have been livid with good reason. So I think it had to – we were really close to it being a black eye, but it all ended up well in the end because of the pass.
Paul?
I didn't think the move was quite as blatant as a lot of people did. You know, as Bo said later, that back straight isn't really straight. It's you know, not totally dissimilar from the straightaway there at Toronto, where you've kind of got the kink in there approaching the last turn, which is the optimal, the prime passing zone. I felt watching it that Takuma, the way he drove that, he was more apexing that kink, which I think was probably a more traditional line that you probably would have seen a lot of other drivers take during the event. The fact that Newgarden first and then Hinch later were trying to make the pass doesn't change what the traditional racing line is. So from that standpoint, I totally agreed with Bo that Takuma didn't do anything out of his ordinary setup or maneuvering down the straightaway to impede their progress. It was just the natural racing line that I think everyone took. From that standpoint, I had absolutely no problem with him letting it go. And if Hinch hadn't gotten by, then Hinch doesn't get by. I mean, we just came out of an era of 2 or 3 or 4 years where we were basically told that the leader had to yield way to the trailing car. That's not what we wanted. Everyone cried foul then. They were happy that the drivers are now able to defend their position in some sort of way, and this is a result of that. I mean, ultimately, if he took the inside line going into the last hairpin, is probably what cost him the non-optimal line that allowed Hinch to get by. So that's kind of the risk you play with when you take that sort of line.
Yeah, and I will say, to clarify my comments now, I feel that it was a block from what I saw there. But I think Takuma, with the tire situation he was in, he was on quite substantially older tires than Hinch was. I think he did exactly what he should have done in that situation. And I thought it was great racing, and I didn't have any problem with what he was doing. I mean, he was trying to stay in the lead there and, you know, kind of forcing the race director's hand to make that call, which, and now he knows that it's probably not going to. So I don't have a problem with what he did. You know, I do feel it was a block, but in that situation, last lap or two, you know, you're on older tires. You got to do what you got to do.
I had a few thoughts on it myself, and I'll run this all by you guys and see what you think. First of all, my impression, and I could be wrong, but my feeling from watching motorsport, other motorsport categories from around the world, is that no other category of motorsport worldwide gets their panties in a twist about blocking nearly as much as IndyCar does. That's point number one. In most other racing series, you'd have to do something a fair bit more blatant than this for the race director to want to break up a fight for the lead. And my feeling on its face is that that's the right move, because darn it, we're out here to race. Racing is not supposed to be a follow the leader or a move over because somebody's coming up behind you affair. It's just not right to not allow a leader to defend his position. Now, that being said, and I'm going to preface this by saying I swear upon anything you wish that I do not worship the ground that my editor at the Star, Norris McDonald, walks on. I swear I don't. But he does occasionally make some very good points. And in the aftermath of Brazil, one of the points that he made was that he thought that IndyCar was going down a little bit of a scary road by allowing this type of racing again, because they have quote unquote forgotten the impact of accidents such as the one that took the life of Jeff Krosnoff in Toronto back in, I think it was 96.
Yes.
And so he sort of, his point about that, and that the move that Stefan Johansson took in that moment was a pretty blatant block, sort of made me take pause and go, oh, well, you know, he's right. That's not a road that we want to go down. But when I sat back and thought about, A, the fact that we're racing and not playing slot cars, and B, that there wasn't anything that Takuma Sato did that he or the other guys on track thought was especially out of line, I sort of was able to take his comments and take a step back and go, okay, he's right to a point, but that doesn't mean that we should stop racing. And I think that everybody, almost everybody involved here, thinks that that's what's happened. And I got to tell you, I would much rather see an end to a race like this than an end to the race like Edmonton a couple of years ago, when Elio was grabbing Charles by the collar because race control was deciding the outcome and not the drivers. And I don't think that very many people would disagree with that. And I think that the fact that we're racing properly again is part of the reason why you're starting to see that build up and that buzz around IndyCar that's been missing for the last little while. That's,
you know, it's funny, when the move on from Takuma happened, the Jeff Krosnoff thing jumped immediately in my head. I mean, that was the one move that it just reminded me. So, and that's what brought Toronto into my head when I was just speaking a little while ago, is that it reminded me so much of that move. And from that standpoint, I understand why IndyCar is leery to allow this. But if I could play devil's advocate with you, Steph, for a bit, you know, you look at some of the other top-level racing series. You look at F1, if you have a pass like that, generally there's quite a substantial difference in speed between the two cars. If you have something in NASCAR, they encourage that type of behavior anyway. If they wreck, they're happy about it. They don't care. They haven't been through the pain that IndyCar has. Whether you talk about the Jeff Krosnoff, you could talk about Kenny Brack at Texas. I mean, brought about by a block there where Kenny kind of moved over on Thomas Schechter. I mean, you can go down the list. Even when Dario went tumbling down the back straight at Michigan several years ago, that was when he kind of moved over, and I think it was Scott Dixon's front end he rolled over there. So IndyCar has this history of very, very bad things happening when drivers make moves like that.
Right, but what you're the situations that you're pointing out and what you're trying to say is the issue with closing speed, right? And that's been something that's been part of the discussion all along. When you've got two or three cars that are legitimately racing at equal ability and speed for the lead of the race, it's a completely different situation than when you're coming up on a lap back marker. It's not like Ryan Hunter-Reay is running out of fuel in the Indy 500 and sending Conway into the fence. This is a completely different situation.
Totally agree. Yes, absolutely.
And you need to be able to make... Now, this coming from me is funny because I spent so long in the Barnhart years saying you can't make judgment calls when you're in race control, but that's the kind of situation where you do need to be able to make a judgment call. And if Hinch was coming up on the back of Sato and he was a lap down, yes, of course, Sato needs to get out of the way to a point, right? I mean, if he's racing for staying on his lap, then we've had that discussion before. He should be allowed to stay on his lap to a point. But, you know, if there is an obvious performance difference there, then that needs to be considered when deciding to take action. When you've got cars racing at equal ability and speed for the lead of the race, they need to be allowed to race. That's what racing is. And that is what Bo Barfield decided to do, and I applaud him for that.
I agree. I think if that move happens anywhere else back in the pack, I think it gets penalized. But as the battle for P1, the last couple of laps, I think that's why Bo decided to let it go. Like I said, it ended up well in the end. It was a great race, and we're all talking about it. So.
And Bo said himself in an interview, I think it was with Marshall Pruitt, that if he had felt after the race that something needed to be done, he could have penalized Sato 30 seconds. And, you know, that may have been what he had decided to do if in the situation that you described, John, where if Takuma Sato had won the race, he might have said, okay, well, that really can't stand because this happened, so we'll take 30 seconds off him and P2 is one. And that's another situation when that would never happen in the world of NASCAR. But that's not what we're talking about here. So that, you know, sits out there in the realm of possibility of ways to deal with it, but it didn't come up, and so that's great. Let's, you know, put that in our pockets in case it's something we ever need to talk about or look back on in the future. One more point that I want to make about this before we move on, just a tiny little observation that I'd like to throw into the hat. The only two drivers that I've seen publicly criticize a decision so far happen to be two drivers from a team that's used to doing a lot of winning, but hasn't been doing a lot of winning lately. Did anybody else notice that?
There seems to be a lot of lot more dissension when you're not winning.
Mm-hmm. I wonder why that might be. Let me just put on my tinfoil hat. yeah. Anyway, shall we talk about Indy?
Yes.
Yes, let's move on. Let's talk about Indy. So my understanding is that the field theoretically sits at 35 right now, but one of those is Ed Carpenter's second car that we think that he only entered in case they needed a 33rd car, which does not appear to be the case. So it puts us at 34, one of which we have not seen at all, doesn't even have a driver yet. That's the 99 that was entered this week with Sam Schmidt Motorsports people. Calm down about the 99 thing, okay? My Twitter handle's 99 forever, and I'm over it. I've had this discussion 1,000 times. Everything that all the old-timers from CART believed in with regard to the 99, you can have all the strong beliefs you want. It ain't happening. Get over it. Let's move on. So the other entry that's at the bottom end of the field there is the Lazier entry, which we haven't seen yet, but we understand because they're on the short program, they're only getting one engine for the entire month, and so they are taking it very easy. The car hasn't even been repainted, as I understand it. That was reported from Chad, More Front Wings, Chad Smith today. By the way, Chad is posting daily reports from Indianapolis Motor Speedway every track day this month. So if you haven't found those yet, please do head to the site and check them out. Chad mentioned that he was by the Lazier garage today and that the car still had the Jean Alesi livery on it. So it hasn't even been repainted, although I assume that it's probably had the different engine mounted in it. But because they only get on one engine for the month, they're taking it very easy. We may see them on track tomorrow, possibly not till Thursday. Other than that, I think we've seen just about everybody that we're going to see. So I'll let you two guys do a little bit of your Indianapolis analysis. Paul, do you want to start?
Well, I think we're definitely seeing that Andretti Autosport brought their big boy pants to the track this year. They have pretty much dominated every day. I think Ed Carpenter was tops on opening day and maybe Newgarden the second day. No, it was I think it was Hinch. So I think they are looking very strong. We saw this last year where Chevrolet came out of the gate very, very quickly, although Newgarden had a better start last year. Chevrolet mopped the floor on qualifying weekend and then it ended up with their pants down during when it came time for the race.
What's with you and your pants analogies tonight? You have pants on your mind for some reason?
Did I?
You're saying pants a lot.
Oh, sorry.
Anyway.
I don't see Chevrolet getting caught empty-handed again this time like they did last time. There, is that better?
Yes.
Thank you. Now you made me lose my train of thought.
You're talking about Chevrolet not getting
caught. Yeah, I mean, they just look so strong this year, and you know, I think at one point today they had, 13 of the fastest 16 speeds today. And now looking at the chart today, they ended up 1 through 6 and 8 through 18. So that puts one Honda in the top 18. And that was Joseph Newgarden was 7th today.
Ouch, not at all what we would expect to see from Honda given the performance last year.
The slowest Chevrolet was Tony Kanaan, which I don't really read too much into. That was at 20th. And then positions 21 through 34 today were all Honda drivers.
Now, I was initially under the impression that Ganassi had really only brought out their T cars so far, but I think, again, Chad in his post today mentioned that they were working on the primaries today. And
they had the primaries out today, yes. The only backups today were the Ray Hall backups today.
Hmm. John, any thoughts?
Well, I wonder, and you guys may be able to help me out on this. I know Graham Ray Hall mentioned on Twitter today that the first couple days he'd been slow, but that they were trying to use up a mileage allotment on the engine and that they were going to have a new piece. And I don't know if any of the Honda teams, other Honda teams, are doing that same strategy, but the Chevrolets are definitely up at the top now. It's just so hard to tell.
I think, well, I can tell you from Chad's post that, again, Chad's post being very useful and informative, check them out, that both Jakes and Ray Hall ran the miles out on their engines today and were expecting to install new engines.
I think both Mike Hall and Tim Cindric today made mention that teams were trying to mileage out their early season engines that have basically gone through. In fact, here's Mike Hull's here, said that both on the 9 and 10 cars, those engines ran the Barber test the first four IndyCar races and the first 3 days at IMS on the first engines of the year for them. Those were both being changed out tonight. So look for them to come out with whatever upgrades Honda has on their new engines tomorrow. Tim Cindric alluded to that he assumed most of the cars were doing likewise, that they would be hitting their mileage limits here shortly. So I don't expect that Ray Hall and Jakes are going to be the only ones that will be getting fresh engines. Obviously, we know the 9 and 10 of Dixon and Franchitti will as well. So I'd look for more of these engines to come out. And it's going to be interesting to see what this new iteration of a Honda engine is, because they're always developing these engines. Every time they bring a new one out, what is this new iteration going to bring, and will we see more speeds from it?
Definitely. Well, interesting. And typically, at this point in the month at IMS, you're looking at the Ganassi cars and going, well, they're probably sandbagging a little bit. But given how the season thus far, and even maybe a little toward the end of last year, has gone, can we be saying the same thing at this point?
Absolutely agree with you, Steph. I was thinking the same thing. And even with the Penske guys, who haven't captured the wins that they thought they would up to this point, I'd noticed some people talking about them being sandbagging as well. I don't think either one of those teams, and especially not Ganassi, they can't afford to sandbag right now. As strange as it sounds to say this, so far through this season, they haven't been good enough to sandbag yet. So they've got to get out there and work on their car and see what they've got.
And Paul? Keep in mind as well, they're going to start, if they are sandbagging, I would look for those sandbags to get dropped pretty quickly, because the weather the rest of the week looks iffy. And remember, Indy pays some pretty good points for qualifying as well. So these aren't points that it's not like a regular oval race where you say, okay, if I qualify 15th, it's not going to take me any time to get up to the front of the field. Qualifying is a big deal at Indianapolis, not only because you stay out of everyone else's trouble early in the race. There's some serious points on the line here. I think, is it half a race worth of points that they doled out here for Indianapolis qualifying? I forget what the number is exactly.
I don't recall, to be honest.
You do
the stats.
I know. I have to go back and look. But there are points on the line here, and it's they're not insignificant by any means at all.
Well, while we're on the topic of engines, let's just remind people of a couple more points before we move on down our list of things to talk about. We're talking about people mileaging out their engines so they have fresh engines for qualifying, but they also get a new engine for the race. So
the full program do.
The full program do, yes. So these guys are running their engines out, getting new ones put in for qualifying, and then I believe they have to set those ones aside to put the new ones in for the race. And then once they mileage out their Indy race engines, they have to go back to the qualifying engines, if they get them, the new ones installed in time for qualifying, before they can go to a fresh one after that, if I remember correctly from last year.
That sounds correct, right.
Yeah. So if they opt not to install their Indy qualifying engine, then they have to take the penalty if they go straight to a fresh engine. I think Alex Tagliani did that at one point last year.
That sounds right, yes.
Just to keep in mind as we carry on, not only at Indianapolis, but moving forward, especially with June being such a busy month, it's hard to keep on top of all these things sometimes, but we try to do it for you. So so there you go.
Just real quickly, Steph, before we move on, qualifying points pays 15, 13, and 12 for the front row. Then goes down from 11 down to 4, starting at 10th place, gets 4 points for qualifying, and it goes down. It stays at 4 for quite a while, then 3 points for 25th and back. So 15 points to sit on the pole versus four to sit on, inside the fourth row. So if you make the if you miss the fast nine, you're down 9 points.
As close as the field's been these last couple of years, that's huge points for qualifying.
That is, and I can't off the top of my head remember how many of the last 5 years have finished within that amount of points at the end of the season, but it's happened more than once. So.
Well, last year it was less than that, wasn't it? It wasn't only a couple points. Mm-hmm. And you think Ryan Hunter Race sat on the outside of the front row, and Will was, where'd he start? Middle of row two, maybe last year?
Yeah. But I mean, we can count that up to so many different things,
right?
Right?
But I'm just saying.
It's just one of many things that adds up at the end of the year.
Yeah, these are points that are not insignificant.
That's right. So let's talk about what we thought was confirmed and now we're hearing is just a rumor and still needs to be ratified, the aero kit situation. So what we're hearing through the grapevine is that IndyCar is talking about a compromise of running just aero kits at just the Super Speedway events next year, just the Triple Crown. Honda wants this. We're hearing that Chevrolet does not. And it's really kind of a bizarre situation and attempt at a solution. Who wants to tackle this one first?
Go ahead, John.
Trial by fire.
I just shook my head whenever I saw this. It seems like they took the worst possible scenarios to roll this out. You're going to debut it at your biggest race at the 500. You're going to run it for only the Triple Crown races when the fact was that everybody was saying that they were cost prohibitive to begin with. Well, the cost isn't going to be any less to develop it. The development is the same for, you know, designing it for one race as it is for 19 races.
And now, a couple of people said that, and I want to stop you there because a couple of people said that, and that's not entirely true because you would be developing. No, but you'd be developing a different kit for road and street courses as opposed to maybe short ovals probably would factor into the road and street kit. And so they would be developing a separate kit for just these races anyway and probably Texas on top of that.
And that's a good point. That would help alleviate some of it, but I still just don't see the logic about it. I think John Barnes is the only one I've seen on record so far. He's already having a coronary about it.
He's going to get fined. Anyway, Paul, anything to add?
Well, let me tell you why it does make sense to look at the Triple Crown races only. If you add up all of the practice time and test time IndyCar teams get all year long, what percentage of that happens at Indianapolis in this whole week? You've got to think it's a pretty good percent. If it's not 50%, it's got to be close.
Okay, I was about to say, y'all told me there wasn't going to be any math whenever I came to this.
But if you're going to develop aero kits, and you start looking at developing them for road and street courses, now you have to open up a lot more testing time for the teams to run with those, to play with those. That costs a lot of money because teams are going to use that. If you allow them only at the Triple Crown oval events, most of your development on those by the teams is probably done this week in Indianapolis.
So like you're, they don't have enough to do?
The car is going to be 3 years old by that point. I mean, look at the way they're approaching this week. I mean, there were a handful of guys that didn't even run the first 2 days. So it's not like anyone's really desperate. Let me rephrase that. There are a lot of teams that are not desperate to get track time now, even with this second year, already into the second year of this car.
Let me tell you what my problem is with it, but it has nothing to do with that, okay? I think I've made my opinions on the aero kits fairly clear in the past, that I think it's lipstick on a pig. I think it's going to have very little effect on the performance of the car in the end anyway. But my problem with this concept is that it's going to take a concept which really is only in its whole purpose for existing is to make fans happy who want to see the cars look different, and that's been well established. It's going to take that concept and make it as much more confusing as they possibly could.
Why?
Like, you're watching Brazil and the cars all look the same, and now we're at Indianapolis and they look different. Oh, and we're back at Detroit and they look the same again. What's going on? I don't know. It's ridiculous, and it does not it's going to cost the teams and the manufacturers money, and it's going to do nothing toward the goal that it was meant to serve in the first place.
I don't buy that. Here's why. The Aero kits and variety are for the hardcore fans that are already devoted and want to see these differences. If you took a sideline fan or brought somebody new to a kart race in 1996, I would bet the farm that somebody who first showed up to a race would not have been able to tell the difference between a Radard and a Lola. Now, if you pointed it out, they'd be able to see it. But if they just saw them going by at speed, they probably wouldn't recognize there was a difference. I don't see this as being something to bring in the fringe fans and say, oh, look, those cars are different. There's a little variety. I'm going to watch this. I don't think the fringe fan who's flipping past NBC Sports Network on a Sunday morning is going to notice the difference between a McLaren, a Williams, a Red Bull, whatever, you know.
No. I don't buy that at all.
Oh,
not at all.
I do. Yep.
I wonder if that's because this is going to sound a little pointing fingers, and I don't mean to, but I think that the motorsport culture is a little different in America than it is in the rest of the world. And I wonder if that's the viewpoint that you're coming from, because I can tell you that I don't hear very many other people say that even casual fans of F1 can't tell the difference between a Red Bull and a Caterham.
I think if you strip off the colors, and you just pull in 50 people off the street, say, hey, what's the difference in these two cars? Are these the same two cars going by, or are these different? They're never going to notice.
I find that hard to believe. And I don't agree with your position at all. I think if the purpose of this is to serve hardcore fans, I don't think very many hardcore fans are going to be fooled. And I think a lot of people at this point, this is one person speaking for an entire fan base, which is obviously impossible to do. But my perception from having watched conversations about it is that people are just kind of tired of the conversation. And they want a decision made one way or the other. And all this flip-flopping and this, oh, maybe we could do this, and we're going to have a meeting next week, and you've heard things, but it might not actually turn out this way. Just make a decision and stick with it, or get rid of it, and let's move on with our lives.
I think people had kind of gotten to the point we all kind of thought this was not going to happen, that it had been put to bed, and then it gets brought back as a three-race scenario. And I remember the exciting thing about the Aero kits when they were first announced was, well, one, we had three different manufacturers at the time. Obviously now we're down to two. But it wasn't going to be just manufacturer-specific. You know, it was at first the idea was pitched that any other company could come in and design a body kit if they wanted to, or Aero kit if they wanted to. You know, if they had the money and a team wanted to buy it, they could design it and come up with it. And now we're down to There's Chevys and there's Hondas. They're the only two that are going to be making the kits, and it's only going to be for three races. So it's kind of like, what's the point?
And only the teams that can afford to buy the extra parts instead of using the Dallara parts that they already have are going to be the ones that are going to benefit from any benefit that there may be from installing them in the first place, and there may be no benefit at all. And so then we're back to the situation where people are complaining because all the have teams are winning and the have-nots are struggling at the back, which is the exact opposite of what this was supposed to do. And the whole Aero kit concept was only brought in to begin with as a placebo for the fact that when they made the decision about the new chassis, they didn't go with multiple manufacturers off the top. This was just a dummy.
Yeah, don't be mad at us because we picked a spec car again.
Exactly. And the whole thing is just ridiculous. The racing is fine. Nobody wants anybody to mess with it. And all this is going to do is mess with it, and the whole thing has just gotten to a point where it's really stupid. Just shelve it and make it go away, and put your energy into developing a new car sooner.
That's where I was just going to go. You're so smart, Steph.
Oh, because I agree with you? So
yes.
What happens when I don't agree with you?
Yes,
I'm not
that is
smart?
True. You do have a point. Okay.
I see how that is.
Okay, now that we have Derek Walker, who's now in, and I'm sure we'll get to this later, or now, now that we have him in place as the chief technical guy or the operations guy for IndyCar, how soon do we now start to look toward the next generation of IndyCar? Is it
too? We should be doing it now.
My understanding is that the DW12 was for 5 years, 4 years or 5 years.
How? What was the previous one supposed to be? The IR03.
Three. They were all 3 year cycles, and then you know, a bunch of stuff happened. It seemed like this one was supposed to be for 4 years, and for some reason I feel like I heard 5 years, like this was going through 16 now. But at what point do we now already start to look toward the next generation?
They should already be doing it.
Haven't heard a thing.
And that would be the good argument toward get over the aero kits and start working on the next car. Hey, give us a lights car first. Then get us another Indy car. Like, get your priorities in line, guys.
We can just give the DW12s to the lights guys and then come up with something else.
We might get to that point. It's a little bit ridiculous. But hey, while we're on the topic of Derek Walker, has anybody heard anybody say a single bad thing about the decision to bring in Derek Walker, except maybe Ed Carpenter? And even he was pretty nice about it.
He was diplomatic.
Yeah. There's I haven't heard a single boo about this. Like, everybody is so excited, but I think Derek himself said that it doesn't take long for somebody in this situation to end up being the villain, so we'll see how long the honeymoon period lasts, but it seems that everyone, just about everybody, is in agreement for once that this is the right thing to do for the future of IndyCar, so that's definitely nice to see. Does anybody have anything to add to that? Because I don't think there is anything to add to that, except, yay, Derek, let's see what you can do.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're all counting on
what you wish for.
But the good thing on Derek's side in that regard is that he's been on the other side of it and he knows what he's up against, which is something that his somewhat predecessors, in the role did not have going for them. So.
Now, I will say, this wasn't a negative comment, but and I cannot remember who it was on Twitter that posted this, or else I'd give them props for it, but I did get a laugh. Someone had posted on there that wondered if we found it ironic that the person we hired as the IndyCar director of competition had just failed tech with his team at the ALMS race this week.
Oh, dear.
There's a parallel to the U.S. government in there somewhere, but I'll leave that out.
But, yeah, I got a laugh out of that. But, yeah, Derek Walker, I think it's a great move. I mean, like I said, his name's been thrown around for a couple of years now, and they finally got him in there. So, I hope it works as well as everybody's thinking it will.
But speaking of the leadership of IndyCar, just as they announced that they had secured Derek Walker, the rumor has started because, of course, Marshall Pruitt would have you believe that it started from Marshall Pruitt proposing that IndyCar needed not one CEO but two. Or at least two senior people working under the CEO to keep the team owners, et cetera, out of his face. But so when we've got Derek Walker on the one side covering operations and competition, and then there's still the theoretical opening for the president of the commercial side of things. And one of the people who was rumored to be in the running for that, very strongly rumored, was Zach Brown of Just Marketing, who also has some involvement with Formula One, and he has, it's been reported in several outlets today that he has removed his name from that pool and will be relocating to London, one presumes, to become deeper, to be deeper involved in the F1 paddock, and so that definitely is some not so good news to counter the great news about Derek Walker, but we're now at the point where we're going to see what Mark Miles and IndyCar decide to do with that position. Any theories, Paul?
I never really understood why you needed another person, to be honest. It seems like Mark Miles has been the kind of guy that's wanted to be very hands-on in this operation since he was hired last fall. If he wants to maintain that role, why bring on another very high-profile, high-level corporate executive to do what he seems to be doing fairly well at this point? Mark Miles has great relationships, you know, in the business so far, it seems. He has a great history of running large-profile events and organizations. So unless he himself really didn't want the position, which it doesn't seem like that was the case, I've never understood why we need another Zach Brown type in that role. I don't, you know, I'm sure Zach Brown has a ton of motorsports, direct motorsports relationships. But was he critical to the furthering of IndyCar on the commercial and business side? I don't know. I never got that gist that Mark Miles couldn't handle this job, nor that he didn't want the job.
Well, and now that Zach Brown is out of the running, the strongest rumor seems to be, or the scenario most discussed seems to be, that Mark Miles might in fact put himself in that seat, because his current role is just CEO of Holman & Co., if I remember correctly, and so he could put himself into a more direct position with IndyCar and may very well do so. John, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I just kind of agree along those lines. I mean, when they talked to Mark when he first came in, he seemed in a way to be kind of touting his abilities to run that side of it. You know, he's got the contacts in sports with TV and everybody else that I wouldn't have a problem at all with him taking that role and just going from there. Now they have somebody in place on the racing side. That was always the big complaint with Randy. Now you've got somebody, you've got Derek Walker in there to take care of the racing side. I say let's let Mark figure out the business side of it now.
Seems to make sense. One more topic before we go and throw our hats in with our predictions for qualifying weekend. So it looks as though Kurt Busch may have somehow passed rookie orientation this week when he ran some laps on Thursday the 9th, I think it was, with Andretti Autosport, and everybody's kind of fallen over themselves saying that he might be interested in doing the double in 2014. I mean, it's hard not to care, because that would be a pretty big deal, and nobody's done the double in a very long time. That would possibly be a boost to the 500, but does anybody have any thoughts on the team it's with, the driver it's with, whether it'll actually get pulled off, and who has the most to stand to benefit from it? John?
Well, I have to put my personal prejudices aside on this one, because Kurt Busch is very far down my list of drivers that I root for. That said, there's no doubt that if he were to come run Indy, that it would be huge. You know, a NASCAR champion, not that far removed. A NASCAR race winner, not that far removed. It would bring media attention to the race. So from that standpoint, it would be a good thing. He does a lot of these tests, and he's done a Champ Car test before. He just did the V8 Supercars test at COTA. So I'm not sure how serious he truly is about it. But I mean, if he wanted to do it. He's got a few sponsors on the NASCAR side that I'm sure something could get worked out really easily.
Robin Miller seems to be falling over himself, thinking that Kurt is trying to convince us that Kurt is very serious. Paul, what are your thoughts?
I kind of like the idea, but I wish we could go back to a day 50 years ago where the drivers weren't all so very specialized, where a race car driver was a race car driver, and they wanted to race the best cars against the best drivers and the best races at the best tracks. And it didn't matter if it was IndyCar, NASCAR, Formula One, or sprint cars, you name it, they wanted to do it. And I think Kurt Busch is that kind of driver. Forget what his mental aptitude and his attitude is. He's just a great racer. And I think he showed this week that he's like that. You know, I'd love to see him come and try to go toe-to-toe with the best of IndyCar and see what he's got. You know, we've heard so long that these IndyCar guys can't cut it in NASCAR land. Well, let's bring one of NASCAR's best and see what he can do on Open Wheel's biggest stage. Bring him on.
What's a shame, you make the point about drivers 50 years ago who would just go out and run anything. It's just that there are so many commercial interests these days that prevent that from being the case. Kurt Cavan made the point in his Q&A today that the only drivers you'll ever see doing this from the NASCAR side are the Chevrolet drivers, because they're the only ones that can keep their mark on the IndyCar side. And that creates a whole long list of drivers who would never even be in a position where they, even if they wanted to, could consider doing the double, which is a shame. You might find guys, maybe a Toyota driver would find that, well, no, because they wouldn't let them run a Chevy in IndyCar.
You know, it's funny, though, you keep hearing that argument that a Ford driver can never come to Indianapolis and drive a Chevy. Well, it doesn't seem to bother Ford that Roger Penske has Fords in NASCAR and drives a Chevrolet in IndyCar.
That's different, though.
Why?
Because
why is that
it's
different?
Not tied to the driver.
I think
Roger Penske is at the level where he doesn't need to be a driver. You say Roger Penske, and anyone that knows anything about auto racing, they know who Roger Penske is.
Roger Penske doesn't have the option to run Ford in IndyCar. He's been trying to bring them in, hasn't he?
I don't know that so much that he's been trying to bring them into IndyCar.
Well, anyway. It's an interesting question of if he had the ability to do it. There's got to be some commercial reason why, because he was the last guy with Dodge in NASCAR last year and just left. So I would like to, not that I'd ever get to sit down and chat with Roger Penske, but if I could, I'd love to chat with him and ask him why he decided to go with Ford and not Chevrolet in NASCAR when he's got Chevrolet on the IndyCar side. But
another option then is you look at Ganassi. Isn't Ganassi have Chevrolets in NASCAR?
You know, I don't know that offhand, to be honest.
Yeah, they do. They run Chevy and NASCAR, Honda and IndyCar, and BMW and Grand Am.
There you go. And Chevrolet's in all three of those series.
I guess that's a good point.
You know, you don't hear BMW throwing a fit, or you don't hear Honda throwing a fit that Dario Franchitti goes to the 24 hours of Daytona and runs a BMW, do you?
But that's all in contracts. And my understanding is that the contracts in NASCAR are a lot tighter.
Maybe.
Well, I know
but
some
if Ganassi wanted Juan Montoya to come to Indianapolis and run a Honda?
Would never happen anyway. Not these days. I don't know if you'd fit in any car these days. Terrible to say. John, what were you trying to jump in there with?
Well, I was going to say, on a more mid-tier driver like Juan or somebody like that, I can see it happening. Now, I think any of your flagship drivers that are really tied to a mark, like a Carl Edwards, it's not going to happen. You know, mm-hmm. Ford chipped
Jimmy
in
Johnson.
Money. Yeah. You know, I know like with the example of Carl, Ford chipped in money to keep him at Roush, to keep him from going to Joe Gibbs. You know, they're not going to let him be seen in anything but a Ford. Chevy's not going to let Jimmy Johnson drive anything but a Chevy. Mm-hmm. You know, but you get people with some of the smaller teams. Actually, in this case, it would almost kind of help Kurt that he's had all those issues, that he's only now with a Furniture Row team, where he's not going to be in his ironclad of a contract where he could go do that. Mm-hmm. Hell, he could probably go run for one of the Honda teams if he wanted to. I doubt he's that tied into it. But the upper tier guys, I don't think it would ever happen. I don't think they would let a Kyle Busch come and run one of the other makes.
And yet, Kimi Raikkonen goes rally racing on his off weekend, so everybody's different everywhere, I guess. I guess it really just comes down to the personal contract arrangements of the driver, and of course we can't be privy to that, but we'll just see as time goes on who wants to give it a go. It's a shame that it hasn't happened as much lately. I know that Randy Bernard, one of the things he was pushing for was moving back the start time of the 500 to make it easier for drivers to consider doing the double because he thought that it would be a powerful marketing tool. I don't actually know how tight the logistics would be. Obviously, if Kurt won the Indy 500, that would be problematic, but don't know how likely that would be, but you never know.
Well,
anyway.
The time for the 500 is back now to what it was when the drivers first started doing the double, when John Andretti did it back in, what, 94?
Right. Now, see, here's my question for Mr. Indy Trivia, because Indianapolis used to be on different time, daylight time,
right,
than the rest of Indiana, right?
No, Indiana, the whole state of Indiana used to stay on Eastern Standard Time year-round, which during daylight saving time was the same central time.
Because I remember when I was younger, the race started at 11 Eastern.
No.
Did it not?
No, it started at 11. Well, Eastern Standard is what they put it out as, which was 11 o'clock Central Time, noon Eastern Time.
Right. Okay. And
Which is where it's at now.
That's right. So they did actually make it so that it's the same. Okay. So that's one potential barrier overcome. And, I guess we just sit and wait. Be interesting to see what happens next year with regard to that. But for now, let's finish talking about 2013. We've got qualifying weekend coming up, and let's see what you guys think. Who do you think you'll see on the front row? Start with the poll and work your way across. Who are we going to put on the spot first? Paul.
I'm going to put Marco on pole.
Mm-hmm.
I'll wave the maple leaf and put James in the middle again where he was last year. And in the middle, on the outside, I just kind of feel like Elio's going to put himself back on the front row again this year.
Okay, John?
I hate to follow up and pick the same person, but I've got Marco tab for pole as well. I'm going to take Elio for the middle of row one and put Hinch on the outside.
Huh. Not very creative there.
I know. I was trying to think of something more creative, but till they prove me wrong, I'm just going to have to go with the big guns.
Well, it's interesting because my pick for the poll was also Marco Andretti. So we've actually got unison here. I think that may be the first time in more Front Wing podcast history. And I do think that James is going to end up on the front row as well. Let's go with the middle just to have some fun. I don't know why, but my heart is telling me that Oriol Servia is going to end up on the front row this year. I have no idea why that is.
Because your tinfoil hat is on, that's why.
I guess so. I don't know. But I'm just, I got to listen to my gut and go with that as my number three pick. It's kind of a wild card, but you never know. Stranger things have happened. It's not like I'm picking, Buddy Lazier.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I wanted to put a Honda up on the front row, one of the dark horses like a Takuma or a Joseph Newgarden, but I just couldn't do it.
Takuma's a good pick, though.
They've been strong.
Yeah. When I started thinking through Hondas, I went, Ryan Briscoe? Not a terrible pick, but the Ganassis just haven't been performing as well as one might expect. So, but Taku's actually a pretty good pick. Not completely outside the realm of possibility. None of them are, I suppose. Stranger things have happened than many things.
That's the great thing about Indy.
Sure is. Let's do the church bulletin just before we sign off here. So we mentioned earlier that our correspondent Chad Smith he's been on site at Indianapolis Motor Speedway every single day since it's opened and will continue to be as long as there is track activities. So he's putting up daily posts and he's posting also on Twitter at IndyCarChad. So make sure to give him a follow and check out his posts. He's giving us some pretty insightful stuff. It's very interesting and it really gives you a feel for what it's like to be at the track. So give those a look. And we also are constantly updating our More Front Wing event summary with the days, time sheets, as well as the combined time sheets for the week of practice so far and any other information that comes our way. You can always find that information at morefrontwing.com/event summary, which we hope that you find useful. And one other thing we wanted to point out, and I'll let Paul take this one because this is kind of his baby. Paul's running a little sort of trivia contest on Twitter. You want to talk about that, Paul?
Yeah, we're just doing a daily contest, usually mid-afternoon, because I get bored sitting in the office sometimes and feel like just throwing some Twitter trivia out there. So we're trying to make it more advanced level, so you're not going to get questions like who was the first winner, who was the latest four-time winner. Some of these are a little bit more in-depth and require a little bit more research. But
keep blowing up my phone. All of a sudden, my phone starts flashing with notifications at about 3:30 every afternoon, and I go, oh, geez, here goes Paul again.
So we're having some fun with that. We'll have a pretty cool, I'm hoping we have a pretty cool prize. I got to work on that this weekend, but we'll announce that soon. And I don't know, until I run out of good questions, probably early next week, we'll play every day, at least over on the weekdays. And like I said, when I run out of good questions, I'll give up and we'll do the drawing probably sometime middle, late next week.
Speaking of running out of good questions, we're going to have to find some questions that you don't know the answer to, because our hope is that next week we're going to put you on Stump the Chump again. The only problem is we got to find a chump because Zach's not available right now. So we're going to go searching for somebody who can be a formidable opponent for Paul, but I'm sure we will have no trouble finding that because there are plenty of people out there. If you're listening to this and want to throw your name into the hat as a candidate, please do send us an email. We're happy to have anybody on who thinks that they can take Paul on in IMS trivia. And if I remember correctly, Paul actually won Donald Davidson's IMS trivia contest a couple of years ago. So he's no
That's
slack. Yeah, no kidding.
Maybe we'll have to find George, see what George is up to
now. I was going to look up George and see if he wanted to go toe-to-toe. I think that would be a fun evening. So we'll announce that on Twitter when we get that set up as well, because we're going to need your help with sending in some questions, as we've done for the past couple of years, to get these guys their synapses snapping and see who we can crown the 2013 Indy Trivia King. And so well, that'll be a lot of fun. We'll get into that next week, and ideally also get an opportunity to talk about qualifying weekend. And oh, hey, there is one prediction we forgot to make. Who's if there is a bump, who's it going to be? Paul?
Lazier.
Yeah. Too easy? Yeah. All right. No point in discussing that then, because I agree on that too. Holy cow.
Wow.
Oh.
The stars are aligned.
Consensus too. Twice in one day. I feel a little unsettled. I think I got to go to bed. So,
on that note, we're going to get the wrong impression of us.
What? What do you think I meant? I need a rest.
Oh, I was going to say that they're going to think we agree about stuff very often.
Oh, okay. No, that also does. Yeah, no. Nah. We can't.
Well, I will say, as an AJ fan who spent the last 6 or 7 years in agony with all the stuff going, don't put it past him to blow an engine in qualifying and have something along those lines.
Don't speak to me about sports fan agony right now. You do owe my Leaf lost last night, right?
I wasn't going to bring it up.
I don't want to talk about it. I still feel a little ill. Yeah, not good. Anyway, so I think unless there's anything else that we forgot to discuss, I think we're ready to call it a night. Guys? Yes?
Done.
Great. John, thank you.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure. And we'll speak to you again probably shortly after Andy to wrap things up. And Paul, I won't thank you because you have to be here.
Mm-hmm.
All right. On that note, we'll call it a day, and we'll be back next week with Stump Chump and some nice Indy 500 trivia for you. But in the meantime, don't forget, if you need IndyCar news and views, get a grip with More Front Wing.
Hi, this is Bobby Unser. It's always better to have more front wings.